This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll find out more from Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek about a possibility of through a new state tax credit program called Moving Forward that some more affordable housing will come to Lake County by the year 2020. And also in the studio, we'll talk with Darnez Gaston from the Westside Leadership Academy and Jakara Ellis with the New Tech Innovative Institute, both of Gary, about an interesting PSA that next month you'll get to see in a theater near you. Lake County and the City of East Chicago could have new affordable housing by the year 2020 as part of a state tax credit program called Moving Forward. It's how officials plan to fulfill a promise to help East Chicago residents who've been displaced by lead contamination. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek reports on the long-term effort and what advocates say officials should do in the short term.
Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority Executive Director Jake Sipe says Moving Forward tries to rethink affordable housing as about more than just a number of units.
We're defining success by the impact that we can have on the community that encourages economic development, but also thinking about the residents' success and how they can continue to be upward mobility on their economics and their jobs and their quality of life.
Sipe says the program started with a focus on transportation and energy, but has grown to cover the whole cycle of poverty and innovative ways to break families out of it. Developers chosen for the program have to hold a workshop to brainstorm solutions before deciding where to build. The latest Moving Forward focuses on Lake County, and Sipe wants at least one project to end up in East Chicago. Governor Eric Holcomb's February emergency declaration for the city's lead crisis directed the State Housing Authority to spur affordable housing development in the area. As part of it, Sipe says they'll try something new at the Moving Forward workshop in November. They've invited two residents who were forced to leave East Chicago's badly contaminated West Calumet housing complex. Uprooted residents want first dibs on any new housing nearby, which Sipe says the state will keep in mind.
They're the experts when it comes to the types of housing that will provide them with the greatest opportunity to be successful.
Housing Justice Attorney Kate Walls has worked in East Chicago for more than a year and says residents need that voice if the state hopes to change their lives.
I think oftentimes what the mistake is with affordable housing design is they sort of come up with it first on their own and then apply it to the community without getting their input.
The developers tapped for Moving Forward in Lake County say they don't plan to do that. Pete Schwiggerod is a senior developer at Ohio-based Miller Valentine Group. He says they work with local nonprofits at the majority of their projects.
To simply house someone is only providing a good home, but to empower someone, you really need to have an approach that includes education and training and betterment systems.
The latest Moving Forward's other developer is Up Development, which ran Chicago's Cabrini Green housing project in 2008 when a rusty gate fell and killed a three-year-old boy.
I mean, it was a terrible tragedy.
Company president Jessica Burzak says Up and the city settled with the boy's family and learned a lot about managing and listening to tenants. That's why she says her company is excited to work directly with East Chicagoans.
I never want to impose a plan on a community or a person, but instead hopefully, you know, add good ideas to what they already desire for their own lives.
The community has plenty of ideas already, including on how public officials can help in the short term. East Chicago residents affected by lead have written to state, federal, and local officials asking them to pay for more relocation of former West Calumet residents and others. No agency has indicated they'll provide that funding, but Attorney Kate Walls hopes they'll reconsider.
That's a standard, if not typical, use of federal and housing community development funds, and I don't think it would leave the state without more than enough resources to do other work.
Jake Sipe with the State Housing Authority says it's done everything the governor asked. Moving Forward's two Lake County developments aren't slated to open until around 2020. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Valparaiso Police Department veteran officer Jeff Ballin is now in charge of the department. We talked with him recently about his new job as appointed by Mayor John Costas and how he sees the future of his city's police force and local law enforcement in general.
I think that my role is to be accessible to the public, to listen to their concerns, be there for the officers and also the employees of the Valparaiso Police Department. I feel that it's important that the police department and the community work together, and that's one of my responsibilities is to facilitate that cooperation.
If you will, give us a brief look at your career. What's gotten you to this point is now the head of the department.
I've been in Valparaiso Police Department for a little over 25 years now. I started out in the patrol division where I was promoted to corporal and eventually sergeant in 2004 when Chief Brickner took over the helm under Mayor Costas. I was laterally transferred into the detective division. At that point, I've been there for numerous years. Eventually, one of my duties was being a member of the Northwest Indiana Major Crimes Task Force. Eventually, I was appointed as the assistant commander of that task force, where we worked many homicides and other type of high-profile investigations. Mm-hmm. I was there for a few years, and then in 2015, I was appointed as the captain of investigations by Chief Brickner, which led me to this appointment by Mayor Costas when Chief Brickner retired.
Mm-hmm. Since you've had a chance to deal with high-profile crimes, you can certainly, I'm sure, have to include this in your total assessment of crimes in the city of Valparaiso. What do you see as the situation right now? There are a lot of crimes that probably go on that people are not aware of. There are also the high-profile things like the opioid crisis that lead to addictions and crimes that are related to that, too.
That is true. I think that is one of the driving factors for crime in Valpo. We're in a relatively safe community, and I believe, though, one of the factors for crime is the drug addictions. Mm-hmm.
You've had a chance over your 25 years with the police department to see the issue grow, unfortunately, and it's unfortunately grown seemingly out of control. When you started as a patrol officer with the Valparaiso Police Department, what incidents did you come across in your work on the street that gave you this clue that the problem with drugs, not only the opioids, but any substance abuse for that matter, what did you see the problem start to be a problem not only for the police but for the community as well?
Well, that probably started early on in my career. Just when you, as a patrol officer, a lot of your calls for service deals with theft reports, burglar reports, DUI enforcement, OWI enforcement, things like that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times when you do come across the persons responsible, oftentimes they're willing to identify a reason for what they were doing. And a lot of times that was because of addiction issues.
So maybe even some cases you talk to people, not only people involved in victims of crimes for that matter, but people involved in crimes too, and you can probably tell for some cases they're high on something, I would imagine.
Well, we always want to find out why someone did what they did, and I think with any avenue, there's, conversation needs to take place, and that's with victims, that's with our persons responsible for it. So, we always want to know why someone did what they did, just so we could help address problems in the future.
Now, besides the issue of drug abuse and addiction and the like and the crimes that come about from those types of incidents, what else do you see as the typical crime in the city of Valparaiso these days?
You have a lot, probably thefts. There's some burglaries. That's probably the majority of the type of crime that we do get.
your time as a patrol officer and then as a detective with the Valparaiso Police Department had to give you a chance to check out some unusual, some high-profile crimes, some very dramatic crimes. I know it's not been all that many years ago that in the city of Valparaiso there was a hostage-taking incident that tied up police resources for quite a while until it was finally resolved. If you will, recall that for us and tell us how you helped with your colleagues there on the police department to basically resolve the problem.
Well, sure. I was part of the team that negotiated the release of those individuals that were taken hostage. Mm-hmm. So, but there were many people involved. The officers that initially responded, the SWAT team members, there were federal and local and state authorities that assisted with that.
Now, in your estimation, taking a look now at that crime that happened, how do you think the things resolved pretty much? Certainly to success, no one was seriously hurt or hurt, and the thing was resolved successfully. And you think that's the way that things have worked out well, and that's the way you kind of follow through to help keep the streets of Valparaiso safe?
Well, I think it's a group effort. I don't think that one particular individual can do everything, and I think it's important to have a team philosophy, a team concept that has things come together, hopefully so we can have good resolutions.
We're talking with Valparaiso Police Chief Jeff Ballin. He's been appointed by Mayor John Costas to take the position as the head of the department. Michael Brickner left to take a position in Porter County government. And Chief Ballin, you've talked about your thoughts about keeping the streets of Valparaiso safe. Are there any new initiatives or initiatives that you're continuing on as the police chief that you'd like to see to be able to reach those goals of making things safer for residents in Valparaiso?
Yes, there's one thing I can say is that Chief Brickner definitely had community service in mind when he took over. And there are a lot of programs that community outreach programs at the Valparaiso Police Department. I want to continue every one of those programs, do a review of each program, see if there's things that we can take to the next level. We're also in the process of reviewing additional community outreach programs that helps us interact with the community. I think that's the biggest part of crime prevention is community involvement. You know, the citizens have to be comfortable with their police department to communicate with us, to reach out to us. I think together is how we move forward. That's my job. You know, one of my visions are, you know, community, improved community relations, inclusiveness, recruiting, diversification. Mm-hmm. I think we have to have a workforce that reflects our community. And I think with that, how we get that information is by partnering with the community to better our city.
And certainly goes along with Mayor Costas' overall plans as well, too, to be sure that the workforce at the City Hall and other elements of city government are diverse and work well with the community. Do you think that in the time that you've spent on the Valparaiso Police Department, that the relationship with the police department, officers, yourself, and others, and the community have gone pretty well?
Very well. I can say that prior to becoming chief, I was involved with a lot of the community outreach programs. And every time we've hosted an event or gone to events, the community support that we had is fantastic. And I think that's such an important part for the city and our community as a whole.
Chief Ballin, let me ask, it's not easy being a police officer. It's certainly considered one of the most dangerous jobs you could ever have. And you're lucky that the force in Valparaiso is able to deal with the problems that pop up and go home in the evenings and tell your family and loved ones that everything went pretty well. Is there anything that you would tell the community that they should know, if they don't already know, about the life and career of a police officer and why it's important for the community to try to work well with police departments?
Well, I think the number one thing to remember is that police officers live in the community that they serve. They have families, they have wives, children, brothers, sisters. You know, the success of our community and the safety of our community is just as important to the officers as it is to the neighbors that we live next to. I think that's probably the biggest thing that I would like to see, and I think as a whole we have that, is that, you know, we're part of the community when we're on duty and when we're off. And I think, you know, it's important that we continue to communicate, continue to remember that we all want our communities safe. We all want better lives, and that we're people too. And I think that that's important to realize and to understand.
Well, Chief Ballin, it sounds like you're very excited to be starting out in this new venture for you, being promoted to be the police chief in Valparaiso, and it looks like a lot of great things are going to happen in the years ahead.
I hope so. I'm looking forward to taking the department, working with the community, working with the officers, and going to a new level.
That's Valparaiso Police Chief Jeff Ballin. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Each year, about 15,000 youngsters with cancer across our country are making the disease now the leading cause of death by a disease for children here in the United States. And it's especially important to note during this month, which is National Childhood Cancer Awareness Month. And it's nice to know that organizations like the Hyundai Hope on Wheels Foundation is providing grants to hospitals across the country to help those youngsters, as well as promote awareness of childhood cancer. And we'll find out more about that here. We're talking with Ryan Darby and with Zafar Brooks, who is the executive director of the Hyundai Hope on Wheels Foundation. We should mention that the hospitals for youngsters that service Northwest Indiana, both the Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago, as well as the University of Chicago Comer Children's Hospital, are some of the recipients of the funding here. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having us. We're glad to be there with you there in Indiana. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we'll open it up here to whoever wants to take on the question first to talk a little bit about the importance that during this month of September we should be aware about the seriousness of childhood cancer.
So I'll just start and tell you about our program. Hyundai Hope on Wheels was begun in 1998. It's an effort by Hyundai and its U.S. dealers to help fight cancer with kids, for kids. Since we began the program 19 years ago, we've awarded over $130 million to pediatric cancer research at children's hospitals all across the country. And you mentioned a few of them in your opening remarks, Lurie's and Cormier there in the Chicago area as well. Each year we fund research grants. This year we'll fund a total of $15 million in total grants for pediatric cancer. Now, September is National Childhood Cancer Awareness Month. And during this month, uniquely, we like to create more greater awareness with the public about why pediatric cancer is such an important issue and tell them the stories of brave cancer survivors like Ryan here and their journeys with this disease.
Ryan, take a moment, if you will, explain the problems that you've run to with your life and how the hospitals have been able to help out, as well as the assistance from the Hyundai Hope on Wheels Foundation.
All right. Well, Hyundai is a huge importance. As far as I said earlier, that one in five kids don't survive. And for those families, it's devastating. I couldn't imagine losing my brother or my mom or just anything. So it's really important that Hyundai donates all this money, because a few years ago, in the 90s, my survival rate wasn't that high. So I don't know that I would be here with you today if it weren't for the great people at Hyundai donating all their money.
Will you tell us a little bit, Ryan, about what you contracted and how you're doing so far?
I'm doing great. I was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia in December of 2009. I'm 4.5 years off treatment now, thanks to all the good work at Hyundai.
Well, congratulations for that, and certainly to the foundation for helping out. Mr. Brooks, you talk about the importance of how the foundation is assisting children's hospitals all across the country, including the two children's hospitals in Chicago that take care of us here in our particular region. How do the Hope vehicles fit into what the foundation does and help promote and certainly and encourage more people to be aware about childhood cancer?
So, you know, Hyundai and its U.S. dealers has been committed to this fight, as I mentioned, since 1998. And we have two goals. Our goal is to fund research and to create awareness. So what we did was we created a program where kids get to sort of show their support, or if you will, we get to recognize these children by giving them a chance to put their hands in paint and something they shouldn't do at home and put their hands on a car. And it's a new white Hyundai vehicle. That vehicle travels the country with various handprints of kids that have been received all around the nation. And it really does just bring us together as a community of interested parties. You know, the childhood cancer advocacy community, the child cancer fighters, the research community, our local dealer partners, everybody that's joining in this fight. And so those hands are a recurring reminder of why we're fighting, of who we're fighting for, and the importance of this fight.
Now, I understand that these HOPE vehicles are going to make 36 stops around the country, and I think one of the stops is going to be in the Chicago area. Can you fill us in a little bit as about when the vehicle is going to be in the Chicagoland area and perhaps how long, if folks over here in Northwest Indiana want to trek over and see the vehicles and help do their support?
Well, we will be in Chicago. I think the day is September 21st. I'm pretty sure that's where we're going to be, and we'll be awarding grants to both Cormier and Lori Children's, I think a combined $650,000 on that day. And they are among one of 40 grant winners for the month of September alone. We think the best way for your listeners to get involved is to visit our website, HyundaiHopeOnWheels.org. When you go to the website, we have something called the September Experience. You can read about what Pediatric Cancer Awareness Month is. You can learn about the gold ribbon, which is symbolic of pediatric cancer. We all hope one day that that gold ribbon will become as well known as the pink ribbon. You can watch videos of kids who are brave cancer survivors and their stories and their journeys. You can read the doctor reports of the grant winners. And importantly, your listeners could also sign a virtual wall of hope. When you sign the virtual wall of hope, you can leave a message for a child or family going through the disease. You can pick one of the hospitals that is listed, and we'll donate a dollar up to $10,000 for those votes. And just show your support by also visiting our social media page and sharing the information, like changing your Facebook profile picture or sharing the messages that you read there on the website.
Now, Ryan, before we go, you've had a chance in the time that you've had gotten your prognosis, a very positive one, that you're doing very well now. Have you thought about the future and what you would like to do and how everything that has come together here, especially with the help from the foundation, helping you out and kind of planning how you're going to live the rest of your life?
Well, sort of. I know that I was brought up into medical. That's sort of what I was seen all my life. So I want to definitely help other kids who went through the same thing that I went through so that no other family has to be as devastated as mine was.
That's great. Ryan Darby is a childhood cancer survivor, and he's also along with us with Zafar Brooks, who is the executive director of the Hyundai Hope on Wheels Foundation. The foundation is sending funds to the two children's hospitals that service Northwest Indiana, the Comer Children's Hospital in Chicago, as well as the Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. Some funds coming in from the foundation that is going to help in the fight against childhood cancer. And gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this. The best of luck to you, of course, Ryan. And Mr. Brooks, thank you for spending time talking about the foundation and the great work that it's doing. And in turn, we'll get the word out to let people know about the visit to Chicago by these HOPE vehicles coming up here very soon. Thank you for being with us today.
Hey, thanks so much for having us on.
Thank you.
It's gross. I don't really want to talk about it.
She didn't want to at first, but I mean, it's no big deal. Everybody does it.
I was ready, totally ready, because we had been practicing this dance for weeks.
He was supposed to take this girl to this dance, but
I sprained my ankle at track practice.
I hate sharing anything personal. It's so disgusting.
For the dance, I let her wear my shoes and she hated it, but I thought she looked great in them.
He could barely even walk.
I ended up taking some pills for my pain.
Yeah, they were my mom's, but
it didn't go well.
If it's not yours.
If it's not yours.
If it's not yours.
Hey, you.
Don't take it.
Don't take it.
Don't take it.
Don't take it. You won't believe what happened next.
What you get when you put together, number one, a council of local organizations in the form of the Lake County Substance Abuse Council, who's concerned about the recent dramatic rise in opioid use and deaths by opioids, and number two, some local students who are concerned about the destruction and devastation that they've witnessed caused by this epidemic in the lives of their friends and loved ones. Well, You get, as the end result, a public service announcement, of course. Well, of course, put together as well a nationally renowned local director and filmmaker to the mix, and that's how we come up with the Hollywood-caliber, locally produced and casted PSAs that will be showing up in AMC theaters in Merivale starting September 22nd through October 17th. In the studio, we have two of the young people who will be seen in that PSA that you get to see on the big screen. We have Diarnez Gaston, who is a student at Westside Leadership Academy in Gary, and Jakar Ellis, who is with the New Tech Innovative Institute of Gary. And they, as we mentioned, are both, I hesitate to say actors, but I guess you are in a way, in this PSA coming up here, along with some of your colleagues as well. Thank you for being with us here on Regionally Speaking to talk about this interesting PSA. And let me, and also too, we should mention Janae Beleza, who is a member of the board of the Lake County Lake County Substance Abuse Council, is with us to talk a little bit about the PSA and about the thoughts behind the PSA. Janae, thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you, Chris, for having us.
Let me start out with you first here, Janae. We are all very well aware of the very sad statistics and the problem itself of the opioid epidemic in Northwest Indiana and around the nation. What, of course, as part of the mission of the Substance Abuse Council is to educate and make more people aware of the problem. What came up with the idea of creating this vehicle to try to reach young people and anybody for that matter, but young people in particular, because they'll be showing up at these movies at the AMC theaters in Merivale?
Well, one of the things that we found interesting was the speed with which this epidemic is escalating, and a lot of it starts with the misuse of prescription drugs. And so we wanted to get the message out that something that seems harmless, like as you'll see in the PSA, it doesn't seem wrong to let your friend use your mom's pain pills because he just sprained his ankle or he hurt himself. It makes sense. It worked for your mom, right? So letting them know that something that seems so simple and so obvious could actually have some detrimental effects that can impact you for a lifetime is a message that I think that needs to get out there. And we were really excited that the youth were willing to be a part of this so that they're friends, their peers, don't start engaging in that kind of activity early.
Now, Diarnez, you and your colleague Jakar are two, as we mentioned, two of the people that you get to see in the PSA on the screen. Tell us a little bit about your classmates and friends that you have met along the way that are the other participants in this public service announcement.
Well, the other two young ladies that were with us, they were very, very pretty dynamic, and they were very fun to work with. And one came from Highland, and another one, she was a college student. So me, personally, I haven't really worked with, like, a diverse group before. So it was a pretty good experience because I really didn't know what to expect. I was nervous walking into a room with them. But it was like once you really get to know them and started acting with them, it became more of a fun experience.
And then, Jakar, what are your thoughts about having such a diverse group that you get to work with for this project?
It was just a very new experience. Like, for me, I never really... I'm new to the acting thing, so for me to actually get out there, do a commercial and stuff, it was just very new. And then I was really nervous, especially watching the two ladies go first, because they was just amazing. But when I came, I adjusted.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about your first experiences when you all got in this, you say, in this room together. How did this all start? Did you... I suppose maybe audition for these parts, or did somebody suggest to you that you ought to be involved in this PSA?
Yes, our director, Mark Spencer, we had done a couple shows with him, and he was like, we would be a good fit for this along with these young ladies.
Now, what did you do in the past that had experience with Mark?
The past, I was in the Watson School to Birmingham, and I was in a Wiz. So, yes, to answer your question from earlier, I am an actor.
And Jakar is the only newbie, I guess. Maybe the ladies are, too. They may be familiar with maybe high school, you know, thespian work, but this is the first time they actually get to be involved in something like this. So you got together in one room, all of you had a chance to meet each other, you know, the first encounter, and sit down. You just do a run through of the script, talk about what you're going to talk about when you're up before the camera.
Yeah, we actually did. But he let us kind of more read it before we actually got into it. We went over it and over and over it to kind of understand and get a feel for each other before we really got in front of the camera.
Yeah. Now, if you had these, I guess, can't call them anything but rehearsals, it was a chance to go, a read-through certainly, and a chance to talk about the script and what you're going to say on camera. Mm-hmm. How many times did you go through this before Mark said, okay, let's turn the lights on, let's get the camera ready to go, let's get this on tape?
I think it was about 5 runs, and really? Then when we was doing it on camera, each line took about 30 takes. It was funny. It was so many takes.
Obviously, nobody really realizes that. That's all the stuff that disappears in the editing process, yes. And it all gets put together into one finished product. How much time do you think that you spent in that recording session, that big long recording session, the multi-take recording session?
I say probably about
an hour or two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's not bad. Now, let me ask some serious points here. Have either of you fellows known of or have had classmates or other people in your lives, in your family, that have gone through the problems of opioids and have a chance to see something, unfortunately, firsthand, and it would in turn make you feel stronger about your own feelings and why you feel that this PSA is so important?
Yes.
Would you want to talk about it?
Oh, yeah, sure. I thought it was just saying yes. But one of my uncles, I experienced it a while back. It was pretty rough seeing him do it. But I really didn't know what to expect as I seen him sticking in his arm. And then just the feeling that he gets from it and understanding that you actually have to stick yourself and put drugs in you just to get that feeling, I knew that's something that I never wanted, because eventually, like we said in the commercial, the drug will rule your life. Actually, we did a play called Stand Up, Change Teen Statistics, which we are doing again, and it explains over and over and over how once you take a drug, if you consistently take it, it will rule your life, and that's what the drug is doing to him. It's ruling his life, and he can't live without it.
That's D'Arnaz Gaston and Jakar Ellis. Tell us about what experiences or family experiences that you've actually had in dealing with the problems of drugs and opioids, of course.
Well, my brother, not recently, but a while back, fell into it. And it was really, because he had a hard life, so that was like the only thing he felt as if he can turn to. Mm-hmm. So when he turned to that, it just made everything worse. He recently is just not coming back from like a rehab. And he's really just now getting back on his feet. So I get told all the time, you don't want to take that road. You don't want to do that. It's things that could really damage your life.
Did the ladies that you are involved in the PSA in talking with them, did they have, they're not here to talk for today, but did they relate any family experiences or personal experiences that they knew about that certainly made them feel stronger against drugs?
Not that I knew of. Okay.
I'm sure they may have been involved or had family members. We'll just have to kind of hope that that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. Now that you've gone through this experience of participating in a production like this, creating this PSA, I'm sure both of you gentlemen and the others involved in the project, I just can't wait to get to see yourselves up on the screen at the AMC theaters in Merrillville next month.
Yes, sir.
I'm waiting.
And I should say this is going to start September 22nd and through October 17th. So it's actually going to be later this month into October as well, too.
It's actually starting this Friday.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Okay, that's better still. That's right. It's better still than September. Janae, let me ask you, what has happened so far now that this project is done and the public will get to see this on the screen through the running of it? Do you know if the Substance Abuse Council is interested in doing more awareness messages like this?
Well, first of all, we're just grateful to have the opportunity to get the message out to the public about the dangers of sharing your prescription drugs. I'm glad, and like I said, I'm so happy that the kids wanted to be engaged in getting this message out. And I'm hoping that what happens is that seeing the message in the format that we presented it, which is much more day in the life of kids and what happens, and them kind of sharing with you, don't do this, as opposed to being told, just telling you not to do it. I'm hoping that the audience will kind of garner a relationship with the kids, like, you know, we were able to watching it as we were finalizing it for the theater, and relate to them in such a way that they can relate to similar situations in their own lives and actually be proactive and do something about it, and know that the Lake County Substance Abuse Council is available to assist them.
I was thinking that this is a very brief message. It's only about a minute, so it'll be running obviously a lot of times when it's at the theaters during the run here in September and into October. And I didn't know if maybe any thoughts were, now that this part of this awareness campaign is over with, that maybe some something that'll run longer, a little longer messages might be in the offing sometime.
Well, actually, there is. We do have a YouTube page where we're going to post this video. And what's going to happen is, if you'll notice when you watch it, there's kind of a tease of more to come, and the tease will happen on the YouTube channel. So
that's great. Well, that'd be great. You have an opportunity. You can run longer messages and be able to still get the word out. You have to let people know it's going to be on YouTube. Mm-hmm. You know, this time around here. One of the things I wanted to ask about here was in talking about this type of way to explain to people. You're hoping that you're not only trying to reach young people your own age, or people just slightly older than you, trying to maybe shake up older adults, and if they're not involved certainly in the problems of opioid abuse, but they have family members that maybe will prompt them to get help for their family members as well. Would you like to see that as one of the end results of this PSA campaign?
Of course,
yes, because. I don't just believe the drugs. When they take the drugs, it's not only hurting them, but it's hurting the ones that they love too. And that's something that they should really look at, because my family is deep in drugs and they don't think it hurts us, but seeing them do it and just watching it, is it tear you up inside.
That's the RNS Gaston. He was a student at the Westside Leadership Academy in Gary. And with us in the studio is Jakar Ellis. He is with the New Tech Innovative Institute in Gary as well. And Janae Beleza is a board member of the Lake County Substance Abuse Council. The Substance Abuse Council has put together a PSA entitled Dangers of Sharing Your Prescription Drug. And it's going to run at the Maryville AMC Theaters beginning this Friday, September 22nd through October 17th. And you mentioned too as well that the videos right now is on the YouTube page for the Substance Abuse Council, if I understand it, and more will be out there in the future.
Well, we're going to actually wait to launch it until after it launches at the theater, because we don't want people getting a sneak peek. Only you were special enough to get a sneak peek.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate that, because at least we had a chance to play it for you on the radio, so you get to hear what it's like. But it's much better if you see it. So,
yes.
So go to the AMC theaters here in Maryville starting in this Friday through October 17th and watch a movie and look for the videos. It'll be a different kind of trailer that you'll get to see on the screen up there in the theater. and both of you, all three of you, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this today. And the best
thank
of luck
you.
To you on the project. And we hope that this particular awareness campaign about the dangers of opioid abuse and the epidemic itself will drive home the fact that number one, Don't share don't share medicines with anybody, and don't take your parents' medicines and take them to your friends as well too. Don't do that, and just stay away from the drugs to begin with. That would just help out too. So, thank you all for being with us today.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
And remember, if it's not yours,
don't take it.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Lakeshore Public Media Professional Women's Conference is a day of learning about leadership, inspiration, growth, and networking. The event's going to happen on Thursday at the Blue Chip Casino Hotel and Spa in Michigan City. The conference presented by NIPSCO is going to be an exhilarating and inspiring full-day event featuring some nationally known speakers, some unique professional development and networking opportunities for all women at all levels in the business world. And whether you're just entering the workforce or you're a seasoned veteran, this is worth checking out. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson talked with some of the sponsors of the event to get their viewpoints on the challenges that women face in the workforce these days.
Here talking with Kaylee Giggy. She's a community manager with In Good Company. Thanks a lot for being here.
Stephanie, it's my pleasure. John asked me to do this, and I was thrilled that I could be here and be able to talk about the conference that they're so passionate about.
It's really great that you guys get involved. We certainly do appreciate that. So tell me, why do you get involved? Why does In Good Company get involved with the conference?
One of the great things about working for In Good Company is their level of generosity they have to their surrounding communities of their properties. And this is just one of the many organizations that they support.
So what do you think women have to offer in the workforce that's special?
Women offer perspective and a different point of view. I was recently reading Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg, and she talked about how she didn't realize how women needed parking when they were pregnant up close to the building until she was there. And I think that that is one of the main reasons why it's important to have women in the workforce, so that we can think of different opportunities. And
because a lot of things that you never would think of, and you get a different perspective. And how do you think women should be supported in the workforce? You mentioned the parking. How do you think women support uniquely in the workforce?
Definitely work-life balance. I think it's important that women feel that they can be good wives, good mothers, and good team members for the company that they work for. And all of that is equally important and large. It's a large part of their life. So I think that as long as their bosses and business owners support them in those, that's the most important thing.
What do you think women bring to a position and to a project in a workplace?
Well, one of the most important aspects of what we do at In Good Company is hospitality. And John and Mike, the owners of In Good Company, own 25 properties, and they are 100% ran by women property managers. And what I know they think they bring to their communities are hospitality and an eye for detail and everything that's important to them in running their communities.
So women, since they're kind of like the decision makers in a household, they make really good property managers, good community managers, because what, they have like a natural aptitude for that?
Absolutely. My background is in finance, and I knew then that women are the power buyers in the family, and it crosses over into apartments and homes as well. Women have tremendous power in the financial sector and in every area of life. So it's very important that women have influence in these areas.
You mentioned some other things before, but I wanted to kind of retouch on it, revisit it again. How do you think, in your opinion, women workers are different from men and what they have to offer that's unique?
Well, one of the things is perspective. I've had the great pleasure of having great leaders throughout my career. One of them, a former CEO at a credit union, and then, of course, John Hicks and Mike Sakich at In Good Company. And one of the best things I bring is that I'm different from them. I learn a tremendous amount from them, and I know in any mentoring situation, you also learn from the people that you're mentoring. So it's been a great relationship with the owners of the company, and it's just been invaluable in my career and my life as a whole.
I wanted to ask you real quick, did you go to the conference last year?
I did not. I'm going this year.
Okay, you're going this year. Great. So what are you looking to get out of the conference?
Mary Lewis was telling me all about the conference and why she's so passionate about it. She's on the steering committee for it. And she was telling me that there were women who made decisions there where they left their job because they knew it wasn't something they were passionate about, to go seek out and find what they were more passionate about. And I think that's what life's all about. It's short, and we're here to do what we're good at. And for a conference to spark that in somebody that's there is absolutely huge, and I can't wait to go this year.
On another note, what do you think are some of the biggest challenges working women are facing today?
I think that we need to be 100% at absolutely everything in our life. You know, I'm a mom, I'm a wife, I'm an employee who really cares about where my company's going and that I make my bosses happy and all of this. And I think it's important to take time for ourselves and reset your goals every now and then. That's why this conference is so important, to make sure that you're going the path that you want to go and setting the trajectory for your career that you want to go in as well. So it's very important that you keep the main thing, and the priorities as straight and as they possibly can be.
So I'm curious, you were talking a little bit about it earlier. You said you have a background in finance. How did you land over at In Good Company, and how did you get into your current position as a community manager?
I worked for an awesome credit union. It was a non-for-profit in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and I became passionate about doing the right thing. That was the main focus there. and my degree's in human resources, and that's where I was in my career at Three Rivers. And I found I really wasn't passionate about the rules side of human resources. I was passionate about the culture side. And as it sat, you know, I think it was a conference I was at that they were talking about living your passion. And I just found I wasn't living my passion. I was in administrative work, and I really wanted to be a bigger part of the industry. And when I was given the opportunity to go to In Good Company, I met John Hicks first, and honestly, he is a tremendous person, a tremendous leader, and I was drawn to the company and the passion that he had for taking care of people and the hospitality in this industry. And so it was a leap to go in a different direction with my career, and it was a good one. It was definitely grows me every single day, and I look forward to growing even further.
So I just wanted to ask one last question, unless you have anything else to add. One of the big stories that's been revisited over and over about income disparity among men and women. Now, in your opinion, do you think that's ever going to be resolved? Do you think that's ever going to be equal?
I think as with anything, in order to solve a problem, you have to be transparent about it. In 1970, women made 59 cents on the dollar of their male counterparts. And in 2010, it rose to 77 cents on the dollar. So 40 years and 18 cents really isn't a huge number. And for everything else and inflation that goes up, I would think it would be in a better position now. But I think it's important that we always bring it up. We never hide it, keep it out in front. And then as more women step into leadership roles, it will eventually work itself out. We just have to move forward on purpose and always be transparent about what's happening.
Is there anything else that you wanted to add that maybe I haven't asked you about that you'd like to mention?
One of the things that I love about In Good Company is their devotion and all of their involvement in the communities that they're in. And like I said, Lakeshore Communications is one of them. And Mary, I spoke with her about the conference, and she was just telling me about how passionate the speakers were and how amazing the whole turnout was. And so I just wanted to thank you for all the good you do for the community as well, because it's so important to give back.
Thanks so much for coming in today. Really appreciate it, Callie, and I'll see you at the conference.
Thank you so much.
That's Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. The Lakeshore Public Media Professional Women's Conference is coming up Thursday. It'll be at the Blue Chip Casino Hotel Spa in Michigan City. Oh, an Indiana wetland near Bloomington recently picked up a national award, despite being one of only a few such areas in the Hoosier State. And Indiana Public Broadcasting Nick Jansen tells us that the Society of Wetland Scientists named Bean Blossom Bottoms as one of only two such wetlands of distinction here in Indiana.
Indiana has lost about 85% of its wetlands over the past 200 years, most of which were drained for agriculture. Sycamore Land Trust's Abby Henkel says many Hoosiers are surprised to learn Indiana has wetlands at all.
A lot of people look at Indiana and they see forest or farmland or city. People don't really think about all these really cool habitats that we have here.
In addition to reducing flood risks, Henkel says Bean Blossom Bottoms is home to many endangered, rare, and unique species, such as the Indiana bat, native orchids, bald eagles, even bobcats.
It's just amazing the number of species they can support. So that's why it's so important to protect areas like this, because these animals don't have anywhere else to go if we destroy their habitat.
Indiana's other wetland of distinction, Twin Swamps, is near the confluence of the Wabash and Ohio Rivers near Evansville. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
Republican U.S. Congressman Luke Messer says he's hopeful that a permanent repeal of the medical device tax can be accomplished before the end of this year. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier tells us, previous efforts to do away with the tax have failed, even though there was bipartisan support.
The multi-billion dollar medical device industry in Indiana has been pressuring Congress to pass a permanent repeal of the 2.3% excise tax since it went into effect as part of the Affordable Care Act in 2013. Congress passed a two-year suspension of the levy in 2015, but proposals to permanently repeal the tax have been inserted into failed bills, including the American Health Care Act. Republican Congressman Luke Messer, who is running for Senate, says he thinks a repeal could be successful as part of a tax reform bill.
And our best near-term likely chance to do that is going to be through a broader tax package that drops corporate rates for job creators, drops business rates so that employers have more money to hire folks and increase wages, and then reduces rates for every working American so they can get a tax cut too.
Both Messer and one of his opponents in the Senate race, Republican Representative Todd Rokita, voted in favor of the AHCA. Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly and Republican Senator Todd Young have both voiced support for a permanent repeal of the medical device tax. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us and hope you'll join us tomorrow.